Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
Hey, everybody, it's Mark Pattison, former NFL player, now climbing the seven summits, and welcome to another fantastic episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. Okay, look, 7-8 years ago, I had to step into the fear and put a big-ass goal out there, and so I decided to start climbing all these crazy mountains around the world. It's been an absolute amazing journey, and you know, I can't believe I'm saying this, but I've actually done 6 of the 7. I've actually been on Denali twice. I've been on climb successfully Kilimanjaro twice, but now it's Mount Everest, the biggest boy on the block, 29,000 plus, and I'm headed over there April 2020, and I'm totally keyed up. And I'm keyed up because I've been doing all this preparation. I train like an absolute bear, and really putting myself in a position of success. I'm going to be climbing with one of the top climbing outfitters in the world. Excited about that. And the mountain has fascinated me for years, I'm sure like others, but really excited to do so. And so if I can actually pull this thing off, I'd be the first NFL player to do so. And so as we speak today, there's not that many first in the world. So I look forward to tackling that. Okay, so that's one. Two is I totally appreciate the listen on these different podcasts. I really do. And it's been an amazing journey, as I said, from not just interviewing these people, but being on the other side of the mic and really taking in their incredible stories of doing amazing things. And look, we all need to be inspired. And so if I can help provide and find more people that meet that criteria, all the better. And we all need that motivation, and we all need that those words of encouragement that you can make it back relevant to your own situation and then plow forward in whatever endeavor you are trying to do. Okay, so I appreciate that. And if you want to find out anything that I have going on, you can do so at markpattisonnfl.com. I've got a book out now called Finding Your Summit, go figure. And it is essentially the playbook to what I had learned from my Hall of Fame coaches on how to emerge and do some great things in your life. It doesn't have to be mountain climbing, of course. It can be anything, but it's a plug-in that you take on these different things, these different goals, that these different strategies that I've set forth, that they set forth for me. And good things can come from that. Okay. Also on the website, you can find out more about my expedition. Obviously, I'll be going to Mount Everest, and we'll have more information about that coming up. There's an e-learning course, and of course, the podcast. And when you go to the podcast, you will find an iTunes tab. And I would be so grateful if you go in and you'd rate and review. Now, it all has to do with visibility, popularity of podcasts, because there's so many podcasts out there today that it's so easy to get lost and like, wait, where's Finding Your Summit? And I really do believe these stories are really amazing and incredible, and can really give a lift to those people who really need it. And even if you don't, we all need to be motivated and inspired by other people to keep going. So if you'd go in and do that, I would be really, really appreciative. Okay? So let's go listen to the pod. It's going to be awesome. Here we go.
Hey, everybody. It's Mark Pattison back again with another excellent episode of Finding Your Summit. And I love interviewing guys like this. His dad once said, you can either be pitiful or you can be powerful. And this guy chose to be in a power position and has lived a life of purpose ever since. His name is Jeff Glassbrenner. Jeff, how you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I was just asking you, what the hell are you doing down in Little Rock, Arkansas? I'm beaming all the way from Sun Valley, Idaho. So I think, you know, I'm sitting at 6,000 feet and you might be like a foot.
No, I'm like 179 feet, I think. Yeah.
Okay.
No, it's not the greatest place to train for mountains, but a great place. So my wife's family's from here. So happy wife, happy life. And so, yeah,
that's
I love
the way
it.
That is. Yeah. Okay. So look. This podcast obviously is all about finding your summit and going through adversity and coming out the other side. And I think, again, as your dad had mentioned, pitiful or powerful, there's all kinds of words that you can pair together, sorrow to happiness or whatever you want to talk about. But I don't know how else to say this, and I want to get it from your words, not mine, but you know, where your life has really taken a right-hand turn is really as a young kid, and then there's a 12-year gap where nothing happened, and we're going to get into all that stuff. But why don't you take us back to when you were a kid, and you were with your dad, you're on a tractor, yeah. And then tragedy struck, and it really had a profound effect in terms of what your life has become and what you had to go through, not all in one big sentence, but we'll work our way through this. But it's, you know, it's fascinating to me on what you've accomplished since, and we'll get into those things as well. But why don't you take us through on going back to when you're a kid growing up and this tragic accident?
Yeah, my big opportunity day in life, I like to call it now, is July 30th, 1980. So I was only 8 years old. And so I grew up in Boscobel, Wisconsin, which is in the southwest part of the state. And so I grew up, you know, like most farm boys, you know, helping my dad out, getting in the way in any way that I could. And, you know, I basically idolized my dad. So whatever he did, I did. And so this morning we were cutting hay and I was riding on my safe spot and we hit a rock and my dad asked me to do my job. And I got off from the safe spot, went around the tractor, removed the rock, removed all the extra alfalfa, and then went to get back onto my safe spot. My dad turned on the machine. In a split second, my life had changed forever. My pant leg became entangled in the power takeoff. And basically, the best way to describe it was like the tractor was a large pencil sharpener, and my leg was a pencil. And so from that moment, I just remember looking down and I could see just bones sticking out, or just moments earlier, you know, I had my whole leg. And I remember looking to my right, and I could see my shoe with my foot still in it. And so from that moment, I just remember crying to my dad. I'm like, I'll never be able to run or never be able to swim again. You know, those were my two favorite activities. And then from there, he just said, son, let's get through the day and worry about all the rest of that stuff later.
Okay, so let's break this down because there's two perspectives, right?
Right.
So you've essentially just had your leg snapped off, and from the pictures that I've seen, it's a below the knee, which is a game changer, by the way. We'll get into that, but it's a below the knee amputation.
Right. 5 inches below the knee, yes, sir.
Okay, 5 inches below the knee. So from your standpoint, you know, obviously anybody that would have their knee whacked off, their leg, you know, they're going through this excruciating pain. There's like terror. I mean, I can't imagine the emotions, and I want to hear about that. And then on the other side of that, as a parent, which you now are, which I am, you're sitting on that side of the fence just going, oh my God, and not even recognizing so much of what your dad had just done. But just like, as you know, the survival skills of a parent of trying to save their kid all kick in all at one time. And so can you go through really quickly on how that played out?
Yeah. So it was a really kind of a moment, you know, when dad saw that, you know, he had the presence of mind to pick me up and apply a human hand tourniquet. So, I mean, he remained very calm in that survival situation. So the doctors would later on say that if he hadn't done that right away, I would have bled out and I would have died. So as much as, you know, that was a tragic day, you know, he saved my life. And so it was just truly amazing to see that roller coaster of that day, and yet to see him being so calm and yet so matter of fact, this is what we need to do. This is where we need to go. And so they took me to the hospital, and they sent my dad back out into the field to get my foot to see if they could use any part of it for you know, going forward.
So I'm just listening to what you just said. And, you know, as a parent, if somebody said to me, "Hey, Mark, can you go out in the field and pick up your kid's foot?" I mean, all the emotions of guilt, of sorrow, of I just don't even know the range of emotions that somebody would go as you're actually looking for your son's or daughter's foot. And then you pick it up, you put it in a bag and, you know, like,
Put it on ice and take it back. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I didn't really truly understand the magnitude of what he had to go through until, like you said, until I became a parent. And so I have a special needs daughter. So she has a seizure disorder. So she has up to 100 seizures a day. And so, you know, when I'm not there to, you know, pick her up when she falls exactly in that moment and she gets a little bruise or something, I feel really poorly about it. I should have been there, you know? And so I can only imagine what my dad felt and had to go through all those years.
Yeah. So I have a daughter also who has a seizure condition, and with Lamictal, a type of medicine, and some other treatments we're doing right now, biofeedback, it's been able to bring that down to around 10, and it's still, you know, you
want zero. Yes. Yeah.
You want zero for everything. That's the goal, because we had to pull her out of the University of Arizona on a medical withdrawal this last semester. And so, you know, there's just limitations, and every day is a battle. And so we can,
but every day is a good battle too.
It is. And every day I think this transitions really well back into you and your life, because every day I honestly feel like today is the day that things are going to get better.
Always.
Right. And this has been going on for her since she was 6 years old. And now she's 20, and there's new treatments, and we've gone this down this path and that path, but you know, it's like anything, you're not going to stop until you have your kid fully healed.
Right. Never.
No, never. Okay. So now you go into your dad's going through his own trauma. You're dealing with your trauma. You're recognizing that, you know, your life is going to change, as you said, forever. You've got half your foot gone, especially as a young kid. How old were you at that time?
So 8 years old. So you're very young.
Yeah. So, and that's really the prime of when I think, like youth sports, football, basketball, baseball, volleyball, soccer, everything. I mean, everything, and everything pretty much requires you using the use of your legs. I mean, that was certainly where I've gone in my life and my career. I mean, it's been everything. My foundation, my base, my power, everything has come from that. And so I can only imagine. So now you go in and the doctor is, you know, as they're patching you up, they can't reattach, you know, your old foot onto your leg. So that's gone. And now you're faced with this new life. And what do the doctors tell you about the prognosis of you, really about your life forward?
Right. Well, back then it's a different mindset than what it is today. Back then they handed me a sheet of paper and they said, "This is what you cannot do." And at the top of that list were sports. They didn't want me playing any sports. They didn't want me hurting myself or hurt their kids or anyone like that. And so the real sad thing about it is I believed in all those limitations that the doctor said I couldn't do. They said, "Play life safe and you'll be okay." So that was hard to hear.
So somebody setting limitations on what you can achieve in your life.
Yeah. They told me I couldn't do anything. You play life safe and that'll be good. You study hard and you'll do well.
Okay, so, and I'm sure I have this wrong, but this is what I thought I had read, was that the prosthetic that they had given you was a wooden peg leg, right?
Basically, it's a little bit more than that. They had some carbon fiber and some components on it, but basically they had to whittle it out and get that ready. So it'd take them 3 months to build, but then after the 3 months, sorry about that.
Yeah.
After the 3 months, I had already outgrown it. And so it never felt comfortable. It never felt real. And it never felt a part of me. And so it was really hard just to kind of be whole again, because I could never have that leg that felt right. And so I didn't like it. I kind of resented being an amputee. I didn't, you know, feel comfortable about being myself. And so that was a really, really hard time for my life. And that's when that kind of, you can be pitiful or you can be powerful, kind of came into being.
But how do you manage that? Because it sounded like your sister was a star athlete, and you know, as you have proved now, you're pretty damn good at one yourself. And and so, and having that competitive drive and having that edge and having, you know, like in your mind, you're playing these games, but going through high school, going through grade school, it, where you're not participating, you know, like how did you process that information?
It was so hard for me because I was always competitive. Like you say, my sister was a star athlete in every single sport she played. It just really felt like I was sitting on the sidelines, kind of just chomping at the bit for something to be able to do other than my sister's chores and my chores. So she had to go to practice. I had to do her farm chores and I had to do my farm chores. So I got a little bit stronger physically.
Yeah. Well, a lot of, I think what goes on is when, for me at least, is that I've seen the people that I speak to around the country is about all about getting off the sidelines and back into the lane of life. Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. And there's one thing about just not being motivated about making that choice. And there's another thing about somebody putting physical limitations on what you can do. And maybe, you know, it's come full circle in terms of really building that mental grit that you need to have to do some of these things that we're going to talk about as you go forward. So you go through this period of time, obviously you're in this place where you're stuck, even though you didn't want to be stuck, and your sister was a star athlete. And I think you said there was this period of time of about 12 years where there was little activity in terms of being on the sporting field, of being competitive and everything else. And so if I would do the math right, so now you're around 20 years old, right?
Yeah.
And so what happens in terms of the light going off and saying, maybe I can do this?
Yeah. So I got my big opportunity hopping to the restroom. My leg was hurting one day. And so I had my leg off. And so I'm hopping to the restroom and this kid stops me. He's like, "You're missing your leg." And right away I'm thinking to myself, this guy must've been the valedictorian of his class. You know, hey, wait a second, obvious, buddy. But then he's like, "Let's go play basketball." And I'm like, "Well, the doctors won't let me play basketball, but, you know, thank you for the offer." And he goes, "No, I mean wheelchair basketball." And so I went with him the very next day, and I got to see him play wheelchair basketball. It turned out that he was an amputee, but he was wearing pants, and I couldn't tell that, you know, he was missing his leg as well. Yep. But that moment really kind of set it forward for me. But yeah, I was lucky enough to find another mentor, my coach, and he kind of took me under his wing and taught me the very basics of wheelchair basketball. And then I got competitive and then I got pretty good at it.
Well, it sounds like you did, because you ended up going to three Olympics.
Yeah, three Paralympic Games.
Paralympic Games, and you won it twice. And one time you actually scored 60. I don't know how somebody scores. I mean, like Michael Jordan does this. And even on my best day with both my legs and, you know, on a high school team, you know, I mean, if I scored 20, I was a star.
Yeah. 20 was just a very average game for sure.
Yeah.
But 63 was a great day at the office. Yeah. So I had 27 rebounds and, you know, one assist too. So very important to mention that.
So how does that whole process work in terms of obviously you have to have some physical disability to qualify to be in a wheelchair to play basketball. So that's one part of it, right?
And right. Then the second, so different classifications. Yeah.
Yep. And then the second part of that is, like, how do you make your way up onto a team like that? You know, where you're ultimately chosen as an Olympic athlete.
Yeah. So that's just a lot of hard work. You know, you getting to your level, it took a lot of hard work. It took talent for one, but more than that is, if my teammates were working out 2 or 3 hours a day in the gym, I was working out 6 or 7. So I was doing whatever I could to try to get on that team. And so a lot of hard work, trying out the different equipment to make it work for me, and just a lot of belief in myself.
Yep. And where did you go around the world to make that happen?
Yeah, so I went to the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater, and that's where I first learned to play. But then I played on the national team for 15 years, and I played overseas professionally for 3 years, 2 years in Madrid, Spain, and 1 year in Rome, Italy.
Really? What kind of money is that?
So it's good. I mean, I get all my expenses, and I was like 6,000 euros a month. And so a car, apartment, and anytime I wanted to fly home, I could. So it was good.
Wow. What a great way to see Europe. So
yeah, exactly.
In terms of the Olympic Games,
right?
You know how they're all over the world, in Athens, yep, and Japan, and here and there. Where were they located at?
So where I did, I competed in 2000 Olympics in Sydney, and then the Athens Games in 2004, and then Beijing in 2008.
What a great experience.
Yeah.
What an awesome experience. Okay. So now you've, you know, you're this wheelchair Olympian, playing basketball for a long time, 15 years, taking a big chunk of your life. At that point, is it the whole concept around, I want to start running marathons and I want to start doing Ironmans? Yeah. Is that where that kicked in?
It really kind of did. You know, like early on, the biggest motivator for me is someone to tell me I can't do something. And so when my doctors told me I could never run or never be able to swim again, you know, I believed them until I saw the Ironman World Championships on TV. You know, like most of us have seen it, it's about all these compelling stories about people getting to the finish line of this triathlon. Yeah. And after that, I Googled it, and it was a lot harder than that hour program led you to believe. You know, it's a 2.4-mile swim, 112-mile bike ride, and then a marathon 26.2-mile run. So a long way and a long day. And so, but then, you know, I had to go out and get prosthetic legs made and designed to help me get to my start line, let alone to get to go to my finish line. And so it was really important that I had all of that figured out.
Hey, this pod is sponsored by Laird Superfoods. So many products to choose from your Instafuel, your coffee, your tea, your smoothies. And I love the superfood creamer and use the hydration powders like the beets, the coconut, the matcha, the turmeric to mix all into my 7 Summit smoothie. And it's so good. Log on to LairdSuperfood.com and get your 20% off when you use the code MarkP20. Okay? So get your Laird Superfood and I guarantee it will help fuel your journey.
Yeah. So let's talk. I want to talk about the game changer of being a below the leg amputee versus above. And then I want to relate that back to this running this race. Okay. So I was 2 years ago, I was down in Tanzania, climbing a mountain for my second time, Kilimanjaro. And I was part of this whole Water Boys.
So people who
listen to this podcast know about my involvement with Water Boys. Chris Long won. He just retired last week, and he won the NFL Man of the Year this year. So it was great to be a part of him. I played with his dad, Howie. But one of the gals that he invited along was a former Marine, Kirsty Ennis, and she had an above the leg amputee, and she was the first person to ever climb Kili with her condition, and she literally hopped up. And
so what year did she climb it?
This is two years ago. Yeah.
Well, she wasn't the first amputee. So a friend of mine,
above the knee.
No, that's not correct either. Sandy Duquette from Colorado did it like 6 years ago.
Okay. So I stand corrected, yeah. But however you want to slice it, hopped up the mountain. Right. And it was just, it was amazing to see her, you know, everything was going great until Summit Day. But anyway, the whole point where I'm trying to go with this is that when it's above the knee, as I understand it from her, is that it's a game changer, because just the mechanics and the leverage and everything else that you have versus when it's below, it's just you have a lot more power, stability, other things like that that can help you do these things that you're doing. I don't know if the word is easier, but it just seemed like it is more challenging when you go higher up in the leg.
Yeah, it's definitely more challenging and definitely more expensive. So a lot of times she'll have either a mechanical knee or a robot knee. And so that is twice as expensive as what my legs would be. But I only have 5 inches below the knee and I'm missing my fibia. And so mine is actually as challenging as above the knee. So doctors, you know, the prosthetics, they said, oh, you'll never be able to run, but I can run. I can run just fine.
So let's jump back to these marathons and these races in Hawaii that you're doing, right? The Ironman, which is crazy, right? So for those people who haven't looked at a TV set or poked their head outdoors, crazy race. It's a long way. The race is a full marathon, so that's 26 plus miles. The swim is something like 2.5 miles.
2.4,
and then you're going to ride your bike over 100 miles, right?
112, yes, sir.
Yeah. So when you're running, there's that South African years ago that ended up having a tragic story and killing his girlfriend and all this stuff.
But Oscar Pistorius.
Yeah. Yes. They call him sling blade, right? So rather than have a shoe, he was more of a blade that he was running on.
Yeah.
How does that work for you in terms of what kind of equipment that you use?
Yep, I have the exact same leg, but it's funny, like a side story is like everyone thinks that's cheating with those legs and stuff. It's more efficient and all that. That's not true, but What was cheating in his part is he had his legs made, he's a double amputee, so he has legs made taller than what he normally is. So normally you'd measure from wrist to wrist, and that's typically how tall you are.
Yeah.
And so he's like 5'10", and he had his legs made for someone that's 6'6". And so that's the unfair advantage. And so a lot of people think, oh, you get that special leg, you can, you know, propel forward and rocket forward. No, it doesn't work like that, unfortunately.
Yeah. Wow. So are you still running these races?
So I haven't done an Ironman in 2 years because I'm focusing on the Explorers Grand Slam. And so for me, I do a lot of swim, biking, and running, but I don't want to race because I'm focused on my mountains right now.
Yeah. Well, listen, you did 23 Ironman. So for you to say, I'm not doing them right now and taking the day off or something, I think a lot of people give you the pass on that. So, certainly I do. Okay. So this pattern then of continuing to really challenge yourself, to push the boundaries, to do things that people have told you, that these doctors way back when, that you could never do this on your checklist. So now we get into the whole mountaineering thing. We're going to talk about Everest and some things that have been near and dear to you and what the Explorers Grand Slam is. So let's transition into the mountains, right?
Okay.
So now you're you know, you're running on these marathons, you're doing things that most people can't do, even with two legs. And
I think you're wrong on that. I think everyone can do it, but they just choose not to.
Well, that's true. That's actually, thank you. Yeah, you're right. So what was that idea about trying to take on Everest and some of these other mountains?
Yeah. So most of the time in my life, I feel like I'm on top of the world and I truly wanted to be there. So we moved to Colorado for treatment for my daughter's seizure disorder. And so we got medicines there in Colorado. And I met Chris Warner, someone that was on your podcast earlier.
Yep.
And, you know, and we went to his gym and climbed, and I just kind of fell in love with the sport. And so I went to climb the Grand Tetons, and that was my first time ever at altitude, and my first time ever technical climbing. And so that was after like a week of meeting these people. And it was called Paradox Sports. And so a group of disabled athletes that were climbing. So I went with them, and 2 months later, I love standing on the summit, love being a part of a team. And then 2 months later, I went and summited Aconcagua. Yep. And that was actually my first time ever sleeping in a tent. And so that was pretty cool.
Wow. You know, I've done 6 of the 7, but Everest coming up around the corner, and we'll get into that in a minute. But the thing that it would seem like would be a challenging on Aconcagua is when you're coming off the summit, and now this is, you're going down to, now the summit, for those that don't know, is just under 23,000. So now you're going down to a 14,000 foot camp on the other side, but there's a lot of shale and scree, as they call it, like this loose rock that's coming down. And I would just think that'd be challenging if you didn't have your full stability. So obviously you must have had things working for you, your trekking poles and other things, but that was just like drove me crazy. Same thing a little bit on Kilimanjaro too, right?
Yeah, a little bit. So scree skiing, I'm a pretty good downhill skier. And so it was great just to use the trekking pole, just kind of scree ski all the way down. So I actually really enjoyed it because it was much faster than just, you know, slugging down walking.
Yeah. So good. So now you do Aconcagua, and going back to the comment you just made about really wanting and enjoying that fact about being on top of the world and looking down on these different mountains. Obviously I share the same passion as well. How did Everest for you kick in? And the reason why, before you answer that, the reason why I want to ask you about this is because for me, I've gone around and really took me two tries to conquer, I'm not sure conquer's right, to summit Denali. Finally did that last year, and then I was down at Antarctica.
Congrats.
And did that. Yeah, so I've done six, like I said, 6 of the 7, but my purpose around a lot of that was just to hone my skills as
Everest.
John's got, set for Everest, right? So you're not taking the shortcuts because I know you're going off to Russia to climb Elbrus here.
Yeah, next month. Yes, sir.
That's awesome. It's a great mountain. It's fun to be in that country and just learn that culture. But
it's different,
It's very different. So tell me why you decided to take Everest and move that to more front of the line versus waiting a little bit longer.
Yeah, I just think that me doing all these Ironmans and stuff, I'm in very good physical shape. And so I wanted to do it while I was younger. And I had the time and stuff. So for me, I don't have to be an expert at something, but the second I dive into it, I become an expert. I need to know everything about the prosthetic. You know, I find mentors and I find people that, you know, that believe in me to get to my summit. And so I'm very fortunate, whether it's wheelchair basketball, whether it's Ironman triathlons or mountains, I've always had that mentor, someone that I can, you know, call or someone that I can go train with and kind of work out the kinks. And so for me, after talking to my mentors, I'm like, why not go for Mount Everest? You know, you're younger right now, you're in great physical shape and you know all the skills. So why wouldn't you go for it?
Yeah, well, well, I'm older than you. So, you know, I should have done that maybe many years ago, but it is what it is. And I've continued to be in decent shape. So I'm looking forward to that next
year. It'll work out.
Yeah. So tell me your take on your experience, number one, on Everest. And then number two is tell me your take on this insaneness that's going on right now on Everest with the crowds.
Yeah, for me, Everest was really, truly life-changing. Just the strength of the people. I remember hiking into base camp, you know, the 9-day, 40-mile trek into base camp. We were getting passed by, like, these grandmas with, like, big packages of, equipment and stuff that were going through us, going past us up the mountains. And it was just the strength that they had. And just, they always had a smile. I mean, they were passing us some flip-flops and we were in our nice, you know, expensive shoes and our expensive equipment, but, it was just that, you know, grounding of nature. But Everest was really hard because it's 2 months away. And so the hardest part physically, you know, I think that anyone can do it, but the hardest part is mentally. You know, can you keep your stuff together for 2 months straight? You know, you're thinking about your family back home. You're thinking about, you know, how comfortable it could be back home, but yet you're, you know, in a tent with, you know, a couple other teammates and, you know, you don't have a lot of time to do things. You know, you're thinking about either staying where you are, going down the mountain or going up the mountain. So life becomes really simple. And so, but you miss home a lot. And so that's the hardest part. But for me, it was just the most amazing experience just to be a part of it and then be fortunate enough to stand on top of the world.
Yeah. And then what would be your take on what's going on up there right now?
Yeah, it's kind of a mess going on right now with all the people dying and not doing really well. But it's kind of, in my opinion, that this is what they signed up for. And the risks are there. And a lot of people are there that really shouldn't be there. They haven't done the training. They haven't done the other mountains. They're not physically prepared enough. And honestly, they didn't pick the right teams. There are low-cost providers that are out there that are, you know, save you, you know, tens of thousands of dollars. But that's fine if you know you can do everything on your own. But if something does happen, you know, the other teams have a better infrastructure in place, a better plan in place to help get you off that mountain if need be. And so I think that's the big thing is like when I did it, there were a lot of people that were suffering and they had to turn back and it was hard to see them give up on their dream, but they made the right choice. You know, you can only go so far, then you need to turn around. But as far as waiting in line for that long, that's pretty crazy. The year that I did it, we had a bunch of people, but it wasn't crowded like that. I stayed at the summit for 25 minutes, you know, kind of soaking it all in. And there was only six of us up there. So it wasn't like it was jam packed. So we had good conditions and an amazing guide. And so, and a great team. And so we all kind of had each other's back and that's what you need to. I think a lot of these other companies, they kind of, everyone's on their own. And so you need to kind of build that, you know, a team atmosphere up and then go for it if you have a chance.
So who did you climb with? What outfitter?
Yeah, Madison Mountaineering, Garrett Madison. And so he's based out of Seattle, amazing guy. And so the coolest thing about him is I was contacting all these people about, you know, saying that I'm an amputee and, you know, a couple of them are like, no, we don't want you on the team. And I'm used to people overlooking me, you know, just because I'm a little bit different physically. And so that was hard. And Garrett's like, you know, I'm not going to let you come meet with you to see if, you know, if you can do this or not. And so he flew into Denver and we hung out for 2 days and, you know, got to know him as a person. We trained together and he said, from this point, you need to go to Ecuador. And if you pass that test in Ecuador, then you can join my team. And so a lot of people think that, you know, if you just have the money, that's great. But there's also a process behind it. And so you have to have a team, you know, that's fully functional and a team that, you know, kind of knows what's going on.
Yeah. So I met Garrett down in Antarctica in January and then I've gotten to know him since. And so certainly he's a consideration who I might go with. And he's a great guy. And I think he just completed his 10th summit on Everest, which is really cool.
Amazing.
Which is really amazing. And, you know, I want to go back to your comment that you made before about inexperience. My tent mate down in Antarctica this last January. So we're talking 5 months ago. It was a guy named by the name of Don Cash. And Don is one of the, And Don was one of the casualties that happened on Everest. And, you know, he did exactly what you did. I predicted that something bad was going to happen to him back in January to others privately, just because of his inexperience. Good guy, great family man, but just, you know, just a lot of things that you got to have in terms of self-care, self-awareness. He just didn't seem to have those tools, you know, in his tool shed. And so, you know,
and that's dangerous. It's not only dangerous for him, but it's dangerous for you.
Well, yeah, it is. And there's some things that happen on Summit Day up there on Vinson in Antarctica. But, you know, the bottom line is he was really jacked up about this low cost carrier that he was trying to get me to go with. And I said, well, why don't we have a conversation when you get back? Yeah. And
you can't do that.
No. And, you know, ultimately it costs his life. And so it's tragic. And hopefully they're going to do a better job of really filtering out who can be up there and who can't. And
do you think they will, though?
I don't. But what I also hope, I think, in addition to everything you said, which I agree with, is, you know, the weather window is so tight that everybody just like rushed to the top all in one day. And then people would have had a little bit of patience. I was with Ed Veaster, as a friend here in Sun Valley. And we got together last week and he said something that was interesting. And that is, to your point again about being up there for 2 months and you start to get ants in your pants, you really got to exercise summit patience. And we all want to go. You want to get out of there. You want to tag it and then get back to the States, you know, but you just have to have that mentality going into it. And so and it's good advice because I'm somebody who wants to get and go. And I just got to be, when that moment comes for me, I just want to make sure that I'm very patient about not trying to rush to the top like all these guys did and then something bad happened.
Right. Well, let's back that up. There's no rush into the top, but yeah, it's a slow slog. Yeah, but it's fine.
Well, it's rush from the standpoint of on summit day, everybody in position like, let's go.
Right. Yeah.
Hey, I'm excited to introduce our new partner of the pod, Cascade Mountain Tech, an outdoor brand from the Pacific Northwest, which is where I'm from, that offers a great selection of trekking poles. They're incredible. Super coolers, camp chairs, LED lighting, and much more. Right now, Cascade Mountain Tech is offering 15% off your first order by using the code FINDINGYOURSUMMIT15, that is, FINDINGYOURSUMMIT15, when you check out at CascadeMountainTech.com.
So let's move on to the Explorers Grand Slam. So for people who don't know what that is, that's doing the full 7 summits and then skiing to the North and the South Pole. My understanding is that you may have gone to the South Pole. You've done that.
Yes, I did. In 2018, I skied to the South Pole and then also summited Mount Vinson.
Congrats. What a great trip. And that Union Glacier down there, that whole setup with the Australians, is just a wonderful place to be.
It's awesome. Crazy. Yeah. It's always light, so that's kind of crazy too. And so your body's kind of get used to all of that. But great people, great place. And so not too many people get to do that. And so that's part of the reasons why I love doing all of these, you know, crazy, you know, mountains and stuff like that is, you know, it's an opportunity that most people don't take advantage of. And so I'm very lucky and very blessed to have people that believe in me to help get me to my summits and my wife and my family that are completely supportive. So, you know, I think that's the most important part is, you know, having that opportunity and viewing great places throughout this world.
Yeah, I really agree with that. You know, they talk about competitive greatness, right? And competitive greatness is the subset of that is being great when your best is needed. But really a subset of that is really about process. And I can honestly say I love the process. So the process is working out every day. The process is about traveling all over the world, going to these exotic places. I can't say that it's been necessarily standing on the peak, which is obviously the goal.
No.
Those things that you just talked about, the interaction with people from all over the world on your team, other people like Garrett, who I met, you know, that we spent time with, these things that most people would never get an opportunity to go down because they choose to do that. But You know, where else on in the world is Antarctica like? It's not. There's not a blade of grass. It's sunny 24 hours a day. You know, it's
there's no Starbucks. There's nothing. Yeah.
There's nothing. Yeah. So unique experiences for sure. So tell me about what your so you've got Mount Elbrus in Russia coming up.
Right.
So that would be great.
And then I have Carson's Pyramid coming up in October. And then I have to go back to the North Pole to ski to the North Pole in April. So I went there this year, but political relations between Ukraine and Russia got awry. And so we were in a kind of a holding pattern for 14 days in Longyearbyen. And so in Slalovod. So we were there. It's a small little city. And so all the hotels were sold out. So we were sleeping in hotel lobbies because all of our gear was packed to go for the next day. Yeah. And so we waited there for about 2 weeks. And then we finally got the word that it was not going to happen this year. So no one skied to the North Pole this year. First time in a long time.
Yeah, that's a whole different challenge too.
Exactly. Right? Logistics.
Yeah. Well, you also have a floating glacier and so there's a lot of things going on there. So with all this stuff that you've been doing, good for you, obviously. You've got some PR that's come, you know, like anybody who's overcome an adversity like this and move forward. One of the things I thought that was really cool is your whole connection with The Rock. Right.
Yeah.
And there was a movie, Skyscraper, that came out. I saw that movie. I love that movie.
But, awesome.
How did that whole thing come together where they ask you to come on set and consult? I'm not sure what the right word is. Be in the movie, whatever you did. But there was this really cool movie between you and Dwayne where you guys came together and he was really taken by your story and what you become.
Right. So I was on HBO Real Sports with Bryant Gumbel. And so The Rock does The Ballers, which is a series on HBO. And so the producers gave him my cut of the HBO Real Sports. And they're like, well, you should, you know, meet this guy. And so it was the weirdest thing. I got this email right before I was going to Russia to climb Elbrus for the first time. And it was an email, hey, this actor wants to come, you know, come and talk to you or you come talk to him. And I'm like, well, I'm pretty busy. I'm going to Russia. And like, well, this actor is The Rock. And I'm like, well, I can be available, you know, we can do that. And so they flew me up to Vancouver and I was on set. And so I got to be there for 2 days and hang out with him on set. And you saw the movie is where he's running on the scaffolding, jumping onto the skyscraper. I got the little action and cut for that little segment. And so it was really neat. I got to speak to the cast and crew and then got to hang out with him a bunch. And it was so cool because he really wanted to learn his role. And so he asked me all about what it's like to be mentally be an amputee, what it's like to be physically like an amputee. And so he wanted to make sure like his limbs were, you know, amputee like and stuff. So I gave him the amp stamp of approval. And so, we had a lot of time to talk. And so the greatest thing about him is he's the most humble individual you'll ever meet. Just most down to earth. You see, he's really cool in the movies, but man, he's even more fun in real life and stuff. So that was really neat. We finished up on the set like 1:30 at night. I asked him, well, you know, what's the plan for him tomorrow? And he goes, well, I'm going to sleep for 3 hours and then I'm going to wake up and work out. And so that's how he started his day. So I really believe like him is just be the hardest worker in the room. You know, you don't have to be the most talented. You don't have to be the most gifted, but what you do have to do is work hard. And so, you know, if anything, he's taught me that more of that, that's so important that, you know, no matter what gifts you have, there's nothing can beat someone that can, you know, outwork someone else.
Yeah, no, I love that. I think he played football at the University of Miami.
He did, yes.
Yeah. No,
he got cut. Yeah, he didn't make the NFL. He played in Canada for like one season in the CFL, but I don't think he got very far after that.
Yeah, well, you know, he is a big, massive dude, and you know,
6'5", 270, and I am not.
Yeah, so I mean, you can understand how difficult it is to make an NFL roster. You know, just you have to have a lot of forces working for you all at the right time, but.
Right.
So you're out today, public speaking. Have you done a book?
I do have a book. It's called The Gift of a Day. And so it talks about my experiences prior to Everest and prior to climbing mountains and stuff. So it talks a lot about my daughter. And I really believe that every single day that we're given is a gift. And so some people choose to, you know, kind of face that day with positivity, just kind of go with whatever comes your way.
No, I love that. Look, you're clearly a guy that sees the world in the right with the right set of lens in terms of the world of possibility and positivity. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's only, you know, life is too short, right? These things happen all the time where people have accidents, they die for unfortunate reasons, or right. you're just, you run your life. I mean, I'm looking at where I am in my life.
Right. And so is Everest worse than dying for you?
Well, I just don't look at it. I don't see
exactly.
It that way, right?
Exactly.
I'm doing everything I can to, you know, I think it just, as it relates to that question, when you take a look at the death rate, it's like 3%. So if 300 people
exactly
right go up there, and so you already have the odds stacked in your favor. And now there will not be another person on the mountain that's more physically ready to take that thing on than me. I'm not saying there's not other guys like you that don't have the same at the same level. I'm just saying there won't be anybody more so, right?
Right.
Okay. So, I just take those and I just increase my odds by doing the research on the mountains, a lot of things that you've done to really increase your chances of being in the right place
success.
At the right time on the right day and success.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Awesome. Where can people find you?
So teamglass.com is my website. And then I do more on Instagram. So that's teamglass on Instagram. So that'd be awesome.
Yeah, let's get connected.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Listen, I really appreciate you coming on. I mean, it's a compelling story. And again, I'll end with where I started, which is, just a inspiring story about somebody saying you can't do something just because you had an accident come your way. And you've turned that whole dial around. You've turned it in the other direction. And you've made a life a possibility. And that's really what life's all about.
Right. I think the worst thing in life is, you know, placing limits on yourself. You know, the doctors gave me some limits, but even worse, that I believe in those limits that were placed on me. But then later on in life, I decided there truly are no limits. And so the worst thing you can do is place limits on yourself. So I love that you're going to go climb Mount Everest next year. And I wish you the best of luck, because you'll be, like you say, the most prepared person on the mountain.
I love that. All right. Listen, he is Jeff Glassbrenner. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you so much for dropping in and listening to another amazing episode of Finding Your Summit. Truly incredible people doing spectacular things in life, and I hope you were inspired just like I continue to be. Look, I am super grateful that you came in and subscribed to this pod, and would be more than appreciative if you gave the show a ratings and review on iTunes. Trust me, it matters. And then also go share it with your friends, of course. Okay, until next week, go do something great. And remember, it takes a little more to make a champion. Bye. Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there, because as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, nfl.com. So until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.